Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
So good afternoon and evening. I'd first like to thank all our guest speakers for taking time out of their busy schedules to join us today for the Women in Fire radio show. Our topic today is a topic that we're all very familiar with, which is going to be the coronavirus. And this is a topic as first responders we're dealing with daily. So today we're going to be discussing proper personal protective equipment, the changes we're seeing in the PPE, which is the proper protective equipment, the impact it's having on first responders, as well as the toll it could take on us physically and mentally. I'm sure anyone that's been on social media and follows any local or not even your local fire department have seen pictures of members posting in PPE that they normally would wear on a normal EMS call. And then one where they're wearing gowns and such. They're doing this to educate the citizens that they serve, to not get them excited or afraid when they show up looking like this. So our first guest speaker is Christina Baxter. She's the CEO at Emergency Response Tips, which provides practical evidence-based solutions for emergency response through the development of next generation tools for enhanced situational awareness and responder safety. Prior to forming Emergency Response Tips, Christina was a program manager of the Seaburn for the United States Department of Defense. She holds a PhD from Georgia Institute of Technology and Philosophy. She has a Bachelor of Science in Chemistry from the University of Massachusetts, as well as a Bachelor in Science in Environmental Science. She is also the chairperson of the NFPA Technical Committee on Hazardous Material Protective Clothing and Equipment. So first off, Christina, I'd like to thank you for joining us. And did I miss anything in your bio that you'd like to share?
Oh, that was more than enough. Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
But no, thank you very much for having me here.
Okay, we appreciate it. So can you tell us a little bit about your company and the impact it's had or how it's helping with the coronavirus?
So right now we do a lot of guidance documents on what type of PPE you should be wearing, how that applies for this given pandemic versus any other type of pandemic. We're working closely with International Association of Firefighters as well as International Association of Fire Chiefs to help with their guidance documents to make sure that they are soundly based in science and evidence, as well as operationally relevant. So that's what our focus is, and we have put out a series of guidance documents now on this topic.
So as we see the more cases developing and such, has the PPE changed since when we first heard about coronavirus? Go ahead.
Yeah, the PPE is staying the same of what the preferred or ideal PPE would be. The problem that we're seeing is that the supplies that everybody has of the optimum or preferred PPE is running out. Okay. And we have a problem in the United States where we do not have a large supply of backup gear. In terms of our pandemic planning, we don't have enough stock to allow us to go for long periods of time. So when this occurs, we have to go to what would be less than ideal conditions, but ways that we can reuse gear and things of that nature. So that's what we've been focusing on for the last week, is really what gear can we reuse? And if we can reuse it, how do we disinfect it properly? And how many times can we do that before we lose its protective capacity?
Okay. So it's a very fluid situation then with the PPE.
Oh, most definitely.
Okay. So speaking of that, how you're saying we're running short on supplies and such, just earlier today, someone sent me and I don't know if you're aware of this yet, I think it might have just come out today, the Oklahoma City Fire Department, their COVID-19 response now, since they are limited on the supply of N95 masks and know that they're going to be hard to come by eventually, that they're responding to certain calls with SCBA masks. Have you heard of that, or does your company have any recommendations for that? Or
yeah, so the way I always look at every type of response is to set it to a risk base. And so if we can evaluate the risk of the operator pretty quickly in these types of cases, then each operator would have a different level of PPE that should be associated with the risk that they're against. Okay. So for example, if you are doing direct contact with a patient and that patient has known COVID virus or presumptive COVID viral infection and they are exhibiting symptoms, then you have one set of PPE that's going to be at least an N95 or better. So an SCBA would be far better when you're talking a protection factor of 100 versus 10,000. If you are that next person who is maybe dealing with a patient who is asymptomatic still, so they're not coughing, sneezing, and throwing away a lot of viral particles in your way, or it's a symptomatic patient and you're 3 to 6 feet away from them, then you have a different level of risk and you can likely get away with just wearing a medical mask. And if you get to that lowest level of risk, you end up being 6 feet away from a patient, so you're outside of their cough spray, but you're still there in that same space, then you can start thinking about having no protection or just a surgical mask. And so it's all about trying to minimize the risk. So when we first enter a scene, the best way to do that is either if you think the person can meet you outside, great, have them come outside to meet you where you don't have to go into an enclosed space where you can keep distance. If you have to go in and the person is in a point where they can't come out to meet you, then can you start the discussion from 6 feet in the doorway? And then as you have to get closer, can one person PPE up and go closer and do the work while the others stand back and are available for assistance, but not necessarily having the same level of protection? And so there are all different types of proposals that we're dealing with. Thankfully, with the newer SCBAs today with much better speech intelligibility, then yes, there are a lot of people who are going to go to using their SCBAs, and that's perfectly fine. You will have to decontaminate and disinfect the masks and all of the gear in between patients, though.
Yeah, I think their just a disclaimer, I think their YouTube video was more just to educate the their public that the N95s, the availability is dwindling, and don't be alarmed if this happens when they show up on a call. And that was it. Two of them were going to, they did put in their video about meet them outside. If you do have a mask, if they were saying when you call 911, their dispatch would ask if you have a mask, can you please put the mask on? And then if they did show any symptoms, then one of the paramedics would put the SCBA on to approach the patient. So it sounds like a lot of this coordination is going to be a coordination between the dispatch and the first responders that are going to be responding to the call as well. As far as, okay.
It's so, definitely trying to ensure that the dispatchers are asking the right questions. We've surpassed the time where asking about their travel is actually beneficial anymore, because we have so many localized pockets across the U.S. that saying, hey, have you recently traveled to Wuhan, China? Pretty much useless at this point. Yeah. So now we've got to focus on, do they have a fever? Does anybody have a dry cough? You know, those types of questions versus the original questions we were using, because we're already past that point.
Okay. So I know we see a lot on the news and social media and such as the different symptoms of the flu and COVID-19 and allergies. So you mentioned that you're working closely with IFC and IAFF. How is it to get it out to the public that there are different symptoms, that somebody just has a cough? I'm sure that a lot of agencies are getting numerous calls for someone that just has the standard flu. So how would you?
Sure.
So, I mean, it's like, I guess it's a slippery slope that we're in right now. But how do you determine, I guess, is there a specific, I saw where you had five documents that you referenced. So is there a specific guideline that first responders should be taking?
There are documents that have come out from CDC and others about the symptomologies and comparing the symptomologies between COVID-19, the standard flu, which is in some cases is another coronavirus. And the issue that you end up having is that depending upon the points in the infectious stage you're at, you could have very different symptoms. A lot of people, especially a lot of the younger people, don't have a high fever, or that high fever doesn't last long. Some people have had sore throats, most don't. And so it really ranges. The question you're going to have is, do they have a unproductive cough or a shortness of breath? And while that could very well just be an asthma attack, if they don't have a history of asthma, then we're going to have to make that assumption that it's COVID-19 until we can prove otherwise. And unfortunately, that's going to use up a lot of PPE, but better to be safe than sorry at this point.
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely true, that we do need to err on the side of being more protective than non-protective. So if a first responder was to ask you, I'm sure you've been dealing with a lot of agencies and contacts that you have and such. What's the most common question you're getting from a first responder regarding PPE at this point?
I guess the most common one there's a couple of very common ones. First off is, can I decontaminate a filtering face piece respirator? So those filtering face piece respirators are like the elastomeric N95 and P100. They're not a very structurally rugged type of respiratory protection that we're used to when we wear SCBAs. But in the case of these, NIOSH did a lot of work between 2006 and 2010, as well as Air Force Research Laboratory, on the evaluation of different decontamination methods and how they affected the longevity of that mask. So there's a couple of things that people can do. There is one where you use a microwave, preferably not your food microwave. It's an 1100 watt microwave for 2 minutes. You try to put something in between that rotating glass plate in the microwave and your mask, because that plate can get quite hot and you don't want to melt your mask. And that's one way to try to make sure you disinfect it in between uses. Another one is just to soak it in a 10% bleach solution for 10 minutes, then rinse it with water and then let it air dry overnight in front of a fan. If you can still smell bleach in it, then it's not ready to be reused again yet. So those are a couple of simple ways to decontaminate them. Another way to extend the life instead, which is actually a preferred method, would be to put a medical mask over your N95. So what you're doing there is protecting the N95 from other gross contamination. So body fluids and splash would get caught by the surgical mask, which would then be thrown away between patients. But the N95 would have stayed relatively clean. It would have some viral load, but you could still wear it by using that over cover. That's why you see a lot of people making these homemade masks, which, while they're not a protective mask for respiratory protection, they're actually a mask that is supposed to be worn over your N95. And it's just a protective cover for you to be able to go longer. The reality of an N95 or a P100 mask of that nature is, the more times you take it on and off, the more the poorer the fit you'll have. So as a general rule, NIOSH would say in a point of an emergency where you do get the allowance to reuse it, 5 times is going to be your max, or 8 hours of wear. And the reason behind that is that the elastics begins to stretch and you start losing the protection factor. It starts going below 100 and that's where you don't want to wear it.
Okay.
You have to be very careful also to never put your, if you're saving it for reuse, do not put your mask in a plastic bag. And do not use alcohol on it to clean it, to disinfect it. The reason for both of those is that these filtering face piece masks use an electrostatic charge on the fibers within it as the filtration media. And by using a plastic bag, it'll pull that, as you can imagine, the static electricity would pull that off, and using alcohol strips it right off. So those are the two reasons that we don't use those things on masks. Do you store it in a paper bag in between uses?
Okay. Is there any other guidance or that you could give first responders for responding to a COVID-19 or response?
Well, I think the couple of big things to remember. As you start looking at, we talked a lot about respiratory protection right now, but people are also wearing dermal protection, correct? You know, they're wearing
yes.
either a gown or they're wearing a Tyvek suit or they're even wearing their turnout gear. And we have to remember that the primary purpose of the protective clothing is just a shield to prevent you from having some of the viral particles land on you, which would then be potential for contact transfer from your skin up to your nose, mouth, eyes, mucous membranes. So it's not about material going through your skin. So that gives us a lot of leeway and allows us to use a lot of different materials that we would never use in a chemical sense, or if it were, say, a biological attack, that would be completely different. So we have put out guidance on, especially for turnout gear, how would you clean your turnout gear if you used it? So if you think about today's turnout gear environment, when we leave a fire scene, we do what's called preliminary exposure reduction. And that preliminary exposure reduction is meant to remove some of the carcinogens and things from the turnout gear outside shelf. We have the same type of thing here where we're going into a call. And even if it's not intentional, say you come up to a motor vehicle accident and you have your turnout gear on, as you should, and you get exposed to somebody who ends up being positive for COVID-19. Now you have the potential for it to be on your turnout gear. And so what we recommend is that you follow the guidelines put forth in NFPA 1851. So that's the selection, care, and maintenance for turnout gear. And you wash your turnout gear in the standard extractor at the highest temperature possible, up to 140 degrees Fahrenheit, but not above. And that allows us, 140 degrees, I don't know if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, I'll have to remember that one. But you have to, it's Fahrenheit, sorry. You have to remember not to go above that so you don't destroy the turnout gear, but also not to get as close to it as you can to destroy the virus. And so there's a lot of guidance out on that. In terms of other dermal protection, it's all about getting what you can to minimize that contact. If you have to resort to wearing your station uniform and not having something over it, then that station uniform needs to be washed as well as your skin as much as possible to minimize cross-contamination. But I think those are some of the big factors. Don't forget that your feet and your boots and your footwear of any type gets contaminated as you go into these scenes. So we need to be doing something to decontaminate the footwear and the treads. Definitely not wearing your footwear into the living quarters anymore. So just standard good hygiene practices that we've been trying to implement for the cancer risk reduction is also the same types of things we want to do here. You know, bag your gear on scene. Don't wear it inside your living quarters. All of those different things that you can do to minimize the transfer of contaminant onto your skin, into your vehicle apparatus, or into your living quarters.
Okay. I appreciate that. Does anyone on the panel have any questions they'd like to ask?
Christina, I'm curious about the use of the P100 masks and the decontamination of those. We recently are deploying those in our department. So can you speak to the decontamination of the mask itself, removing the filters and the head straps that are associated with
those? Okay. So you're talking about P100 air purifying respirator versus a P100 filtering face piece, right?
It's a half mask. I don't know the...
Does it have a canister or cartridge that screws in?
No.
Or is it look like a paper material?
It's a paper filter that would look kind of like you would have on your vacuum, maybe? A large paper filter on either side?
Is it... But the design, is it very much like an N95? Or is it
no.
like something that you can replace the filter?
It's you can replace the filter.
Okay. So for those are air purifying respirators. And a P100 air purifying respirator cartridge or canister, a cartridge is plastic around the side, a canister is metal around the side. In case of those, they're actually great for reuse. And the reason behind that is that you just take them off, and those you can actually put in a plastic bag and store. What we generally do prior to putting them away and reusing them is wipe down the outer parts of the canister or cartridge with your disinfectant and then let it dry and then store it. You want to store it, depending upon if it's just a P100, which is just a filter, or if it's one that's like a P100 with organic vapor or a P100 with CBRN capability. Those ones have carbon in them as well. If they do have carbon, then you want to store those in a humidity-free environment to minimize the problems that you could have with taking on water vapor, which would just increase your breathing resistance. In terms of washing the mask themselves, once you take off the canisters and store them, it's just standard procedures that come. They're generally, each manufacturer will tell you how you want them washed. At a minimum, it's a soap and water wash. At a maximum, it's generally a low concentration bleach. Sometimes you'll have an iodine rinse. And all of those things are just disinfectants to make sure that whether it's COVID or any other type of viral particle or material that you may have on you doesn't stay and cause larger growth on the mask. So those are actually a fantastic approach. Minimize your breathing resistance. It doesn't give you the whole weight of wearing your SCBA, but does give you the protection you need plus some.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions?
I do have one. Could you refresh on the masks that you mentioned that could go over the N95s? What were those called specifically?
So they're actually just called medical masks. So when you see those, just a stretchy mask that people wear over, then generally you see them, a surgical face mask, any of those. They're a very flimsy paper mask. They have a little bit of filtration, but they're not an N95 or a P100.
Okay.
So those are not a respiratory protection device. Those are actually just a face wear. And so we sometimes will use those over an N95 or a P100 or something of that nature just to keep them cleaner from the external contamination, the dirtiness. And that's what you're seeing a lot of those homemade do-it-yourself ones.
Got it.
Not something you want to wear as a protection because it's counterproductive.
Right.
But to protect your mask, yes.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions? Well, I'd like to really thank you for providing the information that you provided to us and for helping keep first responders safe, not only in this time that we face right now, but throughout every day for a first responder. We really appreciate everything that you're doing to make sure first responders stay safe on a daily basis. Well,
and I'll actually stay online on mute. If you guys have questions as we go along, then I'll be able to jump back in.
Perfect. Thank you. So our next speaker is Heidi Simon, who's a lieutenant in the South Metro Fire Rescue, which is in the Denver area. She has 22 years in the fire service with the last 10 years as lieutenant. She's also been a paramedic for 19 years. And she has a master's degree in human performance athletic training from San Jose State, as well as a bachelor's in human performance from Arizona. And she's currently studying women leadership at E. Cornell Graduate at Denver University. So Heidi, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us to speak about your agency and PPE and the coronavirus in general. So Christina mentioned that this is a joint effort between dispatch and the first responders, that dispatch has to screen the calls. So have you noticed any an increase in calls since this has been occurring, or a decrease in calls, or can you just give us a little brief overview?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. I appreciate it, and a nice introduction. I haven't looked at the numbers. We've not necessarily seen a great deal of increase in calls related to the COVID situation. However, we're pretty busy department, so that would be hard for me to look at without specifically looking at numbers. We do, as you mentioned, Christina, with the dispatch information, we are employing the emerging infectious disease surveillance tool, which is a screening tool that's built into our EMD process. We're lucky to have our dispatch center within our department. They dispatch a number of departments, but it's kind of our home base. So they have been questioning not only about the recent travel still, but also flu-like symptoms, fevers, cough, difficulty breathing, or other new respiratory problems. And then that will employ the type of PPE that our department uses going into that call. We've also allowed, because of this increase in the dispatch gathering of information, we're initially responding non-emergent to these sick case calls to allow for time for the appropriate EMD process, as well as donning the appropriate PPE. Currently, we're using, we call it PPE times three for all of our medical calls, which would be a mask, gloves, and eye protection. And then also we're instituting the 6-foot initial approach for each patient if we cannot get them outside. If we have a specific primary complaints that are specific to flu-like symptoms or COVID risks, then we also don the PPE times four, which is donning a gown. And we're limiting personnel into the scene to lessen the risk. So that's kind of how we've adapted recently. We have constant changes. We've just instituted the P100 mask for our lead paramedic, who is the person that would be in the back of the ambulance during the transport. And we are currently procuring more of those masks, and we'll have one per riding position for each engine, truck company, and medic unit. We will be sharing those, but we've got a significant decon process that we're going to be going through. And just because of the shortage of the N95s, it's what we've gone to. So I think that's kind of right now what we're doing as far as dispatch and the PPE. We procured the gowns to avoid the potential of having to decontaminate our our personal wear or our bunker gear. We also did institute a few weeks ago that bunker gear would not be worn inside someone's home at any time, unless of course it's a fire or fire related call. So we've cut down on that. A number of years ago, we instituted the footwear policy that Christina talked about. So that's been also reiterated during this time. I think one of the biggest things that we're looking at is decontamination, because we also have, being in Colorado with the weather and the cold, we also have a high number of influenza B cases right now. So we have two situations that we're dealing with and very sick people on both accounts. We are now decontaminating our medic units after any of these high risks COVID questioning calls. We have a specific decon unit that is dispatched to the hospital to decontaminate the unit. And then we've also decontaminated at least one station at this point when we found some potential for exposure from a number of crew members. So we have a full process in place at this time.
So I'm sure that your department had to do some additional training on the COVID-19 virus when it became known that it was out there. Can you briefly just tell us what kind of training you guys have done? Was it, and is it ongoing or?
So initially, probably with every department, the data that was coming in was, some of it was very good data. Some of it was more unsure of its validity. So probably the most important thing that we've done is we've created a clearinghouse and one place, which is our EMS operations captain, that they've been having daily meetings since they our department declared a disaster declaration, I believe on the 19th of March. And since then, we've been having daily meetings around this. The EMS captain is releasing a what we call a sit rep on a daily basis around now. We just got our most recent one. And that has any updates, that has links, any new links, different rules of engagement, different messages from our medical direction, our transport agencies that we're transporting to, because the receiving facilities have different methodologies in which they're receiving patients. Some have, we're taking low acuity patients, they're being transferred in the ambulance bay instead of being taken into the ambulance, just to decrease the risk of transmission from the field into the hospital staff. So those daily sit reps from the one person, the clearinghouse, have been just critical. We also utilize Target Solutions, many agencies probably do, in which we can push out training pretty quickly. We have a very robust training division, both in EMS and in fire, and they have been making videos and sending out documents daily that we review as crew and individually. The most recent one being donning and doffing of that protective gear, because I think we're all pretty good at donning protective gear, but doffing contaminated gear is where we probably get a little bit lackadaisical. So we've just released, thank you to LA Fire for their video, it was very good. They released that. We do a few different things because we were using different equipment, but it was a good example. And then we also just got the training on the P100 masks and how to don them, as well as how to decontaminate them after use, since we are sharing them as well as in case we're exposed. So we've been doing a lot of training, and the state EOC is actually in our administration building. So we have pretty close contact with the state, but I think the state of Colorado has been doing a great job as well of getting that information out to not just the fire departments and police departments, but also to the citizens.
Yeah, that's really great that just one person is putting out the information, so you're not receiving different information from different individuals. That has to help tremendously. Yes. You mentioned real brief that you had a station that had to be deconned. Was it due to people members possibly being exposed to the COVID-19, or can you speak to that or no?
I know very little about it. What I know about it is that there were we have one or two areas in the district that have a number of families that may have been transported and may have had positive results from their COVID testing. We had sent the paramedics that were attending at those home for to be watched, and they've been also tested, as well as then decon that medic unit and then went into the station. You know, and some people, we have both ends of the spectrum, right? We have the, oh my gosh, you went too far, and oh my gosh, you didn't do enough. And the only time that you really think that you didn't do enough is when we're in trouble. And the only time when we think we did enough is when, or did too much, is when it's all over and nothing happened. So it's, I think the department has taken the safest route. We're a busy department. We're running on, we're not at full staffing at this time. We have a couple of academies in place, and one of our academies just canceled. So we're in the thick of flu season, as I said, so we have people shortages there. So I think it's better for the department to be safe and react in the way they did. So, and they're bringing in an outside company to do that process as well.
I mean, that's really great that your department is on top of things, and you're right, we can't be overprotective at this point. So you mentioned the short staffing and such. What is the impact that this could have? Like, I mean, you guys work 24 hours a day, off probably 2 days. The impact it's having on the crews, have you seen any difference in the crews, the mental staff? I mean, just the stress it must be having. You're going on calls where dispatch is obviously screening the call to the best of ability, but sometimes we know there could be a language barrier or such, or people just aren't going to be completely honest of what's going on. And crews are going in. I mean, even if they have the proper PPE on, there's still, unfortunately, the small chance that they're getting exposed to COVID-19. So does your department have anything in place to help with, you know, people that might be being stressed? Kids are out of school right now. I mean, I know you yourself have two small school-aged children or teenagers, and your husband, you know, is also a firefighter. So, I mean, the effect that this is having on people, you know, both at work and then going home. And I mean, if they think they're exposed to it and they're not sure, and then they're going home and they're afraid they're exposing their family to it and stuff. Do you have any programs in place that help with this?
Yeah, actually, it's been pretty remarkable. The department over the last few years has implemented a very strong peer support program, as well as a wellness program that we're pretty proud of. It's kind of exciting. But in these times, particularly in the beginning, the wellness manager was reaching out via email to the crews and really reminding people that we have this peer support system, and our EAP program is very stringent or very strong. We instituted recently a virtual counseling that was set up by one of our counseling agencies that provides EAP services for us. So even if we can't, we have some people that are in maintenance programs for counseling, so they can still participate in their counseling sessions online, just the way we're doing on this Zoom meeting, or they can also, any new concerns, reach out to the EAP. As crews, we've had Linda Willing just put out in Fire Rescue Magazine an article on, you know, maintaining being a company officer during a situation like this, and it was a good article. It's been reiterated actually prior to her even publishing, but probably some sense of normalcy is what keeps us, keeps it together. Now, with that said, we're the counties that we're all in are on stay at home. They just will institute, all the counties that we work in will be on stay at home starting tomorrow. And we have been at a stay at home status as far as a fire department. So we're not doing any group trainings. We're not doing any extra outside activities. So that could add to the stress if we don't put some sort of normalcy into the stations. So we're really recommending that we are following our same protocols. We have a morning meeting every day, kind of go over what the new information is, because sometimes that new information is completely overwhelming to people. So it gives them an opportunity to just to discuss it and ask questions that we can go back and get the answers to. I set the day as we would normally without our stringent training schedule that we normally have. We institute our own. So we spent our time, this is when we're going to work out, this is when we're going to cook, this is when we're going to go do, we always implement some sort of in-station training. We can still go outside as individual crews at this point and do training. My station is really lucky. We have a big parking lot that we can use down the street. So we're still maintaining some sense of normalcy that's our normal daily operation. One of the other things that we're doing is trying to create some, you know, picking out some movies and doing some things that maybe we fell away from doing, where people are taking classes, so they're going to their rooms at night to study. So we're trying to do a social activity every day, or maybe a group workout. Our wellness department, they sent us a bunch of workouts that we can do together, just to keep things going around the house. And then checking in with your people individually and as a group. I kind of try to do a coffee talk and just see how people are doing and let them get it out, because it absolutely is a little bit stressful. We're all homeschooling our kids, and I'm very lucky. I'm a stepmom of two teenage girls with and the girl's mother and us are very close. And she is a teacher at the school, so she's very helpful with this. We're going to take on all the home. It's a great time to teach your kids all the home things, how to turn off the water, you know, the calls that we run. So we're trying to spread that to the crews as well, to recognize that homeschooling doesn't have to be such a stress. It can be fun as well. But I think that the department is really recognizing that it can be, it's a stressful job already, and especially being away from home for 48 hours. So we're just really asking people to be transparent with their stress and communicate with us. And the department is being very gracious with allowing people the time they need to take care of their families. We also are instituting, if you go homesick, we have a temperature control spot in the station that we're monitoring our temperatures when we come in the station and when we leave. And we have a 72-hour stay away from the time that your temperature clears, so that we're not bringing any illnesses, whether it's flu or COVID, into the station. And if we have any illnesses or flu-like symptoms, the department will, we have an advanced resource medic that will come to our house and give us a influenza A and B test. And then we're working on COVID testing. We don't have testing packets ourselves, but getting those people COVID testing if it's warranted. So we have a very strong support system from the department.
It sounds like your department is doing everything to make sure that there is a sense of normalcy, which obviously has to be huge at this point right now. Does anyone have any questions for Heidi? Okay. So I want to thank you so much, Heidi, for joining us. You had some really great information. We appreciate you being out there.
Thank you.
Okay. So our next speaker is going to be Amy, who happens to be the operations chief at McKinleyville Fire in Oregon, as well as she's the president of Women in Fire. And she has an AA in paramedicine, and she is working on her bachelor's degree right now. So Amy, we've heard about what they're doing at South Metro. We've heard about the PPE. Do you have anything that your department's doing that might be different than what we've already heard? Or I think Oregon also might have just instituted in California, we're calling it shelter in place, which probably isn't the proper terminology to be using. How's that going to affect the stations, if at all, if it's in effect in Oregon?
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. I'm going to say I am very impressed by the backgrounds and the resources that our previous two speakers brought to today's show. So that's encouraging. And thank you, ladies. Also, what an amazing opportunity to get to hear some other ideas and options that might be out there. And that really is the nice thing about these opportunities, is to be able to learn from everybody. So some things that we are doing maybe a little bit differently, or actually maybe even similarly, we are as well doing the daily checks in the mornings and at night. We have some state mandates that have come down from care facilities and from the hospital to where they are being required of screenings of anyone coming into their facilities. So with that, we've been able to collaborate and kind of work together as far as what we can do ahead of time and guarantee them that will be done within our organization. And then it's diminished what they'll need to do when we're responding out on calls. So that's been helpful. My goodness, what a whirlwind of the last couple of weeks. Oregon has school out till April 28th. We'll see if that gets extended. The governor did put in place Monday, she announced essentially it's a non-essential activities, a ban on non-essential activities. So yes, it is very similar to what California is doing as their shelter in place. It's interesting just trying to keep the chaos down. And really, as the others have said, it seems that things change by the hour. So just keeping in touch with County Health and with our partners. And we have an organization at McMinnville Fire where we transport ambulance, and we also respond out to other rural agencies. And we have some partnerships where we're overseeing some of the administrative duties for a couple of rural agencies. So working through some of the unique training differences between a volunteer, mostly volunteer department, and then a combination department. We're seeing a lot more technology use with some of our meetings and some of our trainings, which has been really helpful. I know Zoom has been popular in our organization at least, so that's been helpful. Yeah, much the same as far as PPE goes. We are being very cautious about our initial discussion with patients, staying back about 6 feet, asking a few initial questions. Dispatch is asking questions similarly, though it had been initially only on certain calls. So we were asking our providers, just on any interaction you're going to have with somebody, ask the three questions about cough, fever, respiratory illness, and then make the determination of PPE from there. So that's kind of a mouthful all within just a couple minutes. But that's what I kind of, the highlights, I guess, I can bring to the table.
Uh-huh. Hey, I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time out. I know you have to be really busy with work, with your two kids being at home and also being president of Women Fire. So really appreciate you taking the time out to discuss what's going on in your agency as well as in Oregon.
Of course, so thank you.
So our next speaker is Allie Rock. She's the CEO and lead instructor of On the Job and Off, which is an online platform which is dedicated to building more resilient first responders through education and shared experiences. She's also an inspirational speaker, an author, and a publishing company owner. Her memoir is Where Hope Lives. She has a bachelor's degree in psychology from Liberty University and an AA in fire science from Bucks Community College, and she's working on her master's. So Allie, what can you add to this about maybe how to make sure we're checking in with each other while we're at work, when we go home and such?
Yeah, thank you, Lisa. And thanks to all the other ladies sharing really important information. Yeah, there's so much to be talked about when it comes to just the mental health impacts and the sudden increase in stress that we are all feeling from kind of, you know, every aspect of our lives. And I've done a lot of talking in the last couple of days just to kind of how to address this with the first responder community. And I think one of the biggest things that, you know, I find helpful is to acknowledge what a big disruption this is in all of our lives, and to be okay with grieving, you know, what could be considered smaller losses, like, you know, loss of freedom. We can't go on the trip that we had planned, or this conference isn't happening, or all those little things that you might think in the big scheme of things, it's not that important, but it's important in your life. And so it's important to acknowledge those things And to be sad or frustrated or angry over the things that have changed for us. And that doesn't mean that we aren't aware or caring about other people whose lives are severely affected. It just means that our life, it has changed for kind of the foreseeable future. And it's important to acknowledge that. And I think, like in everything, it's really important to talk about how we are feeling. It's important to be able to talk with our kids about how we're feeling, with our spouses. This is weird. It's a weird, hard time that we are living through. And like everyone else has said, this is changing rapidly. So we get used to, you know, okay, it's going to be this way. And then the next day it changes. And so that is going to make us feel a lot of different ways, you know, angry, sad, frustrated, overwhelmed, all of those things. And like in anything else, it's important just to not keep those things in. For me, I have found that, you know, it's really important to be informed about what's going on, right? And especially as first responders, we have lots of different information sources coming at us from either a chief or a township official all the way up into, you know, the federal government, kind of keeping us updated into what's going on. And it's important to be aware of all of those things. But for most of us, there's a line where we're just becoming so saturated with information that it's not serving us at all. And it's just making us be more overwhelmed. And I know, you know, some of us have more downtime than we usually have. And so maybe we turn to social media, but all social media is right now is just more about this virus. And so I think it's important to be aware, be informed, you know, be up to date with what's going on, but to allow yourself to disconnect from social media, from the news, from those things when we get to a point where we're just saturated with information. And like, you know, was said, it's important to find some sense of normalcy in this, even though what's normal changes daily, even though our daily routines are nowhere near what they used to be. You know, kids are home from school. They don't understand what's going on. How much do we share? How much do we, you know, keep from them? All of those things are different, but figuring out a way to maintain some sense of routine in your day to help you not feel so overwhelmed with the changes. And, you know, distraction can be a good thing. And again, that doesn't mean that we're not being, you know, we're not aware of what's going on, but, things that we maybe would try to not do in non-pandemic times, like watching Netflix or watching a movie or doing all of those things, those are okay to do really always, but especially now, we could all use some brain space away from this pandemic, and we have to recharge our batteries to be able to, you know, go back out into the world or go back to work where things are just kind of getting more stressful by the moment. That distraction is good. So it could be reading a book. It could be, you know, taking a bath, journaling, just going on a long bike ride, whatever it is to just kind of reconnect with yourself can be really, really important and needed. And I think, you know, for those of us who have experienced mental health struggles, isolation, which we're all supposed to be doing right now, can be something that's really triggering. I know for, you know, a lot of my friends and first responders out there that have dealt with depression or actively do, they're actively trying to not isolate, to be around people, because that's something that helps them stay well. And so this is something that can be really, really difficult for people who are already sort of struggling. And so I think having resources that we are aware of always, having people that we can talk to always is important, but especially now. And just because we have to physically distance from people doesn't mean we have to emotionally distance. And especially now, we need connection and we need to be talking to people and seeing people, even if that is just like through a window or through the car door or through, you know, FaceTime. And lastly, one of the things that I like to do and that I've kind of been doing with my family since this whole thing has started and as the restrictions on, you know, where we can go have gotten a lot tighter, it's fun and hopeful and distracting in a good way to talk about what we're going to do when all of this is over, because it is going to end at some point. Even if what normal looks like after this is different, there is going to be a day when the shops open and the restaurants open and we all can be out again. so it's helpful and hopeful to talk about what are we going to do, where are we going to go, where are we going to go out to eat, you know, wherever, because that is going to, we are going to get to do those things again. This isn't going to last forever. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
Thanks, Allie. You made some really good points about the social distancing and such and how it could have a big impact on others. I mean,
yeah.
I know here in California this last weekend, it was very warm and there was people out and about and it was all over the news how they weren't doing social distancing. We've been in shelter in place right now for a little over a week. I don't know if anyone really stopped to think that some people need that social interaction. I know I didn't.
Right.
I must admit, I got kind of mad because I was like, don't you guys listen? It's 6 feet and such. But you're right. You made a really good point about the depression and such. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you said
that.
Yeah.
And I mean, we of course have to be, you know, we have to be staying home if we can and obeying all of those things. But there are ways to still be able to connect with people, even if we can't be with them physically. And I think, especially now with all the technology that we have, I mean, there are people that are, you know, hosting a Netflix watch party and you and however many friends can watch, you know, a movie together, or people that will, like, you know, play a board game with six people from their neighborhood and they're all, you know, on FaceTime together. It might take a little bit more effort than it would before, but those things are still possible and we need them now, I think, more than ever.
Yeah, you made some really good points that everybody kind of needs to stop and think about, you know, reach out to people and such, especially if you have an elderly neighbor that might be sheltered
Absolutely.
But yeah, you
yes, absolutely. Yes.
So we're about out of time. Does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask any of the speakers?
I just want to say, Lisa, that I'm really grateful that you guys asked me to be a part of this. I think it's pretty critical that we, as women in the fire service, are speaking to some of these issues. There's people that are going to connect with us in a different way. So I'm very proud to be a part of this. And you guys have a lot of great information. It's just really inspiring. So thank you for including me.
Thank you for joining us. I'd like to close by saying thank you to our speakers. And if there's anything that we could learn from this, I know I've learned a lot from this, is not just this listening to our speakers and such, but everything that's going on right now, is don't take anything for granted. I know previously I'd wake up and I knew I was going to go to the gym, or I can go get coffee, or I could go across the street and hang out with my friend, or that I could do what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it, pretty much. It was just natural and I took it for granted. So I realize now how fortunate I was to be able to do that and how I will be able to do it again. But I just realize how not to take anything for granted. If I just like to add that. And I'd like everyone to just thank you again. Stay safe, and we're not in this alone. We can do it together. And we can make it through this. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And I appreciate everybody's dedication to the fire service and everything we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone.